The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation. Hey everyone.
Welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Kroom.
And I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are almost at the end of their training to become forensic pathology fellows.
Yes. And this, we're recording two episodes today. This one is going to come out while we're residents. The next one we're going to record is actually going to come out when we're fellows.
Yes.
But we're recording it as residents, so we'll still have this well-practiced intro, which is we're gonna have to get used to saying the other thing, which is gonna be weird.
I know. I almost flubbed just trying to change it in a minor way today. I mean, I definitely flubbed. Also, apologies for not having put out an episode in a while. We were both just so relieved after boards finished, we didn't want to do anything.
And it was a little like relief plus also packing.
Right.
I was amazed how like stressed out I've been, and I'm still obviously not done, so I'm still super stressed out from packing.
Yes.
It's amazing how much that just like takes over your life.
Oh, for sure. Luckily, I'm all done moving out of my old apartment.
Yay.
Yes, which I had been in for 9 years. And that's in nine impressive. Years, you accumulate a lot of stuff and a lot of dust.
That's so true.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit lucky that I have been in the same place for 4 years, but I moved from one room to the other room after 2 years. So it was at least a little hip check, but there's still a lot of stuff that I'm donating.
Mm-hmm.
So today we thought that we would do a kind of intro to Seattle on what we think of Seattle before we get there.
Yes.
Some info about Seattle, cool death stuff related with Seattle. And then we could, you know, maybe do another one in a year, kind of summarizing
our fellowship. Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah. Also, this is, I don't know if this is a 2-year anniversary, but it's about a 2-year anniversary episode too.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Because we missed it. We weren't recording during our 2-year anniversary.
Oh my gosh.
So we didn't do the Darwin Award one. Maybe we can do that for the one after the...
After the first time.
After the July 4th one.
That actually sounds great.
Yeah.
You're just full of good ideas today.
Sometimes. I think I'm so sleep deprived right now that just like anything that comes to my mind is like, that's good.
Yeah.
Just say it.
I mean, it's working out. Maybe you should not have a filter. Do you ever have a filter?
I can force myself to have a filter when I need to in the appropriate situations.
Work.
But I don't like my filter.
Yeah.
I prefer to not have one.
Nice.
People around me prefer me not to have a filter as well.
I mean, it's what makes our podcast so great.
Woo, woo. Cole is being good right now, but I apologize if she wakes up and starts going crazy. Also, this is the last podcast recording session where we're just gonna have one black cat.
True.
From so now there on, might be too. A lot of hissing and yelling.
Hopefully not. Yeah. Hopefully we can get them to be friends before we start recording our next round of episodes.
That or they'll just be trapped in our rooms.
Yeah. True. We'll both have our own rooms. Yep. Trap them in.
Doors are our friend.
So to kick off this episode, I'm gonna just start off with a brief history of Seattle, since we both know about the city, but not that much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Seattle 101. I got most of this from the government website.
Nice.
For Seattle.
Best source.
Yes. And so Seattle lies on this narrow strip of land between the salt waters of the Puget Sound and the fresh waters of Lake Washington, which I didn't know was between two different bodies of different types of water. And then beyond that, there are two mountain ranges, the Olympics to the west and the Cascades to the east. So just like geography setting of this place.
Mm-hmm.
And the city was built on indigenous land, as was
surprise,
most of America.
Surprise.
And it was the traditional territory of Coast Salish, which is specifically the Suquamish and the Duwamish tribes.
Well done.
Yes, thank you. I looked up the pronunciation.
Nice.
Pay respects in
that's awesome.
Any way that I can as a non-indigenous person. And they lived in the region for thousands of years before the arrival of white settlers in 1851. And they first established this one town site and then moved across the bay and created this village that they named Seattle, which was honoring the Duwamish Indian leader named Sealish, which looks like self, but it's
kind of also sounds like Cialis.
Sealish. Yeah.
Like the erectile dysfunction drug.
Oh, Sealish. Yes. Oh. So back when it was first built, the economy was based on lumber. Mm. And most of that lumber actually went to San Francisco.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so there's a connection. But it also supplied fledgling towns throughout the Puget Sound region.
Okay.
And then in the early 1870s, the first railroad arrived. The Northern Pacific Railway Company brought its transcontinental railway. And they actually had the hub in Tacoma, which is 40 miles south of Seattle. But they were able to get a line extending into Seattle. And so around 1889, they started getting this boom, and 1,000 new residents per month started arriving in the area.
Nice.
And then the explosive growth kind of slowed. On June 6, 1889, they had a big fire, as was common in small towns made entirely of wood back in this time.
Poor life decisions.
Yes, and it leveled the buildings on 116 acres in the heart of the city's business district. Luckily, no one died in the fire.
Yay.
And it actually ended up providing them with an opportunity to do extensive improvements, such as building buildings out of steel and not wood.
Also, my guess would be, like, now that they have they can make a better plan for the city,
exactly.
And have it set up so it's, like, in a grid rather than cow paths.
Yes, they did a lot of improvements, such as widening and regrading the streets.
Nice.
And they developed a professional fire department. Maybe that's what burned down.
I wonder why that was a priority.
Yeah. They reconstructed all the wharves and built all of these different waterworks. So it was actually like turning lemons into lemonade.
Nice.
Good example.
Nice.
Yeah. And then they had a depression.
Okay.
And then there was the gold rush in the Yukon.
Okay.
And that started around 1897. And Seattle became a boom town again.
Okay.
And in fact, the connection with Alaska, which is where the gold actually was so strong that for a long time, Seattle was considered like the owner of Alaska.
Oh, interesting.
I know. Yeah. Then more railroads started to arrive, which helped increase diversity. So there is a lot of diversity in Seattle because
awesome.
Of that. And then over time, Seattle acquired a reputation for being a big boom and bust economy.
Mm, okay.
Like they kept going back and forth.
Yeah.
So in World War I, because it's such a big ship state, they produced a lot of ships for the war, so helping the Navy and stuff. But then the 20s came around, and so busted again.
Okay.
And then World War II sparked another economic rebound for shipyards, except for the Japanese-American population, which they had a lot of.
Okay.
Because of the 1942 executive order that forced the removal of anyone of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast. So over 7,000 Japanese-Americans had to leave Seattle for incarceration camps. And then after the war, many were unable to recover their homes and businesses.
I feel like I haven't said this recently enough, but white people are the worst.
Yeah.
As a white person, white people are the worst.
As a part white person, white people are the worst. I mean, everybody has their issues, but
white people are pretty bad.
Yeah. Thankfully, in 1984, the Seattle City Council passed an ordinance that provided reparations to city employees of Japanese ancestry who lost their jobs during that period.
Awesome.
So, you know, Seattle knows that it's done wrong in the past and has tried to correct some of those wrongs at various points in time.
Good. Baby steps.
Yeah. And the economic downturn after the war lasted until the 1950s, when Seattle-based company Boeing, of airline fame,
introduced airline fame.
Yeah, they introduced the 707 commercial jet airliner.
Okay.
So it heralded another boom. And then in 1962, Seattle sponsored the World's Fair, which left the city with their Seattle Center, the monorail, and the Space Needle.
Nice.
Yes.
I didn't realize that's what it was from.
Yeah,
We need to do Space Needle because I've never done it before and I really want to do it.
Yeah, I've only seen it. I've never actually gone up in it. I've done the Vegas version of the Space Needle.
I've not been to Vegas either. I need to go to Vegas.
You haven't gone to... Wait, Vegas at all? Oh, neither has Simon. We should plan a couples trip.
Yes.
Go for a weekend.
Yeah. Rob has been talking about wanting to, not like take me to Vegas, but like he's been to Vegas. So.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Okay. Done.
Nice.
We'll find somebody to take care of the cats.
Add it to the list. And then things were, you know, fine. Boeing headquarters relocated to Chicago in 2001, but other companies have since come in to take its place. So Microsoft, Starbucks, Amazon, and Google.
Mm,
so it's another big tech epicenter. So that won't be new in our moving there.
Two of my friends that live up there, they first started working for Amazon, and then they both went over to work for Lyft.
Oh, wow.
So definitely very tech heavy.
Yeah. And then the last little bit I have is the government website. I really liked this. They wrote that modern Seattle has both strengths and challenges. The city is proud of its arts and cultural institutions, its many live theaters, and its professional and collegiate sports. It is proud of its parks, of Pioneer Square and the Pike Place Market, and above all, of the beauty of its surroundings. Meanwhile, the city's growth has led to increased income inequality and a dearth of affordable housing for its working population, while endemic issues of racism, social injustice, and a warming planet continue to inspire demands for change. So I just love how their government website acknowledges, like, yes, it's got all these perks, but it's also got its issues, and
yeah, we need to work on them
to correct them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I've noticed when I was looking up, because I did my focus more on, like, Seattle deaths and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of really good interactive tools on government-sponsored sites. So, like, Department of Health, Washington.gov, and the King County Office of the Medical Examiner. Sorry, Medical Examiner Office, MEO. They have really good interactive websites to look at different statistics around various death stats, which include, like, you know, age, race, location, and they just make it so it's very accessible.
Yeah.
Which really, like, I'm not going to say dumbs it down, but it makes it so more people can utilize that data and understand what's happening where they are.
Yeah.
Rather than it kind of being this vague thing.
Yes. Really visualize the disparities. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Seattle, as I said, they have really good stats in order to make these really good charts, and that really comes from early on when Nicole was talking about a lot of this. Seattle actually started keeping death registers back in September of 1881,
which is
shortly after they were...
Yeah, that's, you know, like 30 years after the first white people came.
1881, Seattle started keeping those death registers. And 10 years later, in 1891, King County started keeping death records.
Mm.
And they kept a lot of really good records. Name, age, sex, race, marital status, birthplace, occupation, place of death, cause of death, and attending physician. These were on every death.
Yeah.
And for the Seattle ones, they were ordered chronologically. The King County ones, this was interesting. It was like first letter of the last name and then chronologically. So all of the T's were chronologically under T, which is kind of random.
Huh.
But then they have, like, just a lot of documentation of various, in various time points. So, like, those that I listed, those two, the Seattle and the King County ones, those lasted until the early 1900s. But then they had a lot of stuff that continued from there. So they were coroner for a long time, which is an elected official, not necessarily a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And they have coroner death indexes from 1890 to 1986.
Oh, wow.
They have coroner inquest transcripts from really early on. They also have this, I think we should do an episode on Potter's Field Cemetery, because they have the record of bodies that were exhumed from Potter's Field Cemetery over, like, the 10 years that they exhumed them. Like, really good in-depth records. And just various things over time. They have something called the Coroner's Scrapbook, which was from 1914 to 1969, included, like, newspaper clippings and stuff from the era.
Oh, that's so cool.
So they just did a really good job keeping all of this, which led to not only do we have, you know, good current data, but they have a lot of good past data too. So it was really, really well done.
That's awesome. I love looking back at, like, old things that list the most common causes of death back in the day, because they're all not
crazy.
Yeah, and they're consumption. Not the names, that we have today. So it's like you need a translator to understand, like, what they meant when they said this thing. So cool stuff.
Consumption is tuberculosis, which I know from one of the other podcasts.
Oh, I know that from Moulin Rouge.
Oh.
So this is probably a good time to clarify that we are moving to Seattle and we will be working for the King County Medical Examiner's Office, because Seattle's in King County.
Yes.
So
we're not just going to be doing deaths in Seattle.
Yeah. King County is the largest metropolitan county in the state of Washington in terms of population, number of cities, and employment. And it is the 13th most populous county in the U.S.
Wow. Context.
Yes. And in 2018, the estimated population was a little over 2 million, most people aged between 25 and 44 years of age, and then about a third of the population are people of color.
Cool.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I remember on our interview day, they told us that it's like a two-hour driving radius, kind of, like, the area that we cover.
Yeah.
So that's the most we would have to travel to a, like, death one scene. Way to a death scene. Yeah.
Which means we always keep our cars fueled up.
Yes. And why I bought a four-wheel drive vehicle.
Yes.
So the King County Medical Examiner's Office, or KCMEO, is accredited by the National Association of Medical Examiners, or NAME.
And then, as I said, they have a lot of really good accessible death statistics online. And you can go into a lot of detail for every year. I'm just going to dive into the most recent year that they have, which is 2019. So as Nicole said, they have a little bit over 2 million people in population. And in 2019, they had, and this is just King County. Mm-hmm. This isn't Washington in general. This is just King County. They had 13,463 deaths. So 13,500, which is a pretty good amount. And the majority of people died from what are grouped under malignant neoplasm. So cancer was the leading cause of death. Second was heart disease, or as they call diseases of the heart, which again, we've talked about before. And then what I found interesting was the next one was actually Alzheimer's disease.
Oh.
I was expecting something else, like number four, which is accidents, yeah, which is more common. But actually in King County, Alzheimer's disease, and often, like, you know, cities have a little older population, not uncommonly, so right, maybe that's it. But I found it interesting that that was the next one.
Yeah.
And that was actually a trend over the past few years, or that was consistent over the past few years, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I would have thought, given that they're having, and we'll talk about this, such a problem with drug overdoses, yeah, I would have thought accidents would have been higher up.
Yeah. And when we go into, like, the homeless population, it is much higher in that group.
Ah.
But it's interesting. And the other thing is, I think that sometimes things get grouped differently from different places. Like, the CDC might not have put in the same grouping. Because when we get into some of the homeless deaths, like, if you just group natural in one group, that's going to be bigger than everything, right? But if you break out the things within natural, they become smaller. So
that's true.
But cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, accidents. Which accidents covers overdoses, which we'll get into. I also found it interesting, life expectancies by race. Most places, white people live the longest. But here, it's actually multi-race lives the longest.
Me!
Yeah! So their life expectancy from birth is 86.3 years. The next is actually Asian with 85.6 years. And then Hispanic with 83.1. And then white people at 80.6. And then black at, black at 76.6. American Indian, Alaska Native at 73.8. And then Pacific Islander is the lowest at 71.7.
Wow.
So, multi-race wins the race.
Quite. Nice. You're I'm going to get a t-shirt that says that on it. A workout t-shirt. And then people will see me run and they'll be like, what? That shirt makes no sense.
Birthday present. Done.
That's a very big difference, though.
Yeah.
It's more than 10 years between.
It's almost 15 years.
That's crazy.
Multi-race is 86.3, and then Pacific Islander is 71.7. Wow. So it's just about 15 years, which is crazy. That's a huge difference.
Yeah.
And then deaths by race are kind of the opposite. You know, the number one, like, you know, deaths per 100,000 people is kind of the exact opposite of that as you would expect. So Pacific Islander is number one, then American Indian, Alaska Native, Black, White, Hispanic. And again, these trends have been very consistent over the past few years. So, you know, they've kind of settled out. And the only big trend that I saw in deaths is cancer deaths overall are going down, and which makes sense because treatment is getting better. From 2019 to 2018, there were about 300 fewer deaths. And then 2017, there were about 100 more deaths in 2018. So it's, you know, it's not a huge difference and it kind of goes up and down, but it's not like a distinct down or uptrend in number of deaths per year in King County.
Although I wonder what 2020 will look like.
I do have some data for overdoses in 2020.
Okay.
I don't have data on overall just because they didn't make these fancy graphs for anything beyond 2019.
Yeah.
But yes, I am very curious to see what the pandemic brought upon us besides all the COVID deaths.
Right.
All the deaths.
Yeah. So one of the things I really liked about the King County office before we even got there is if you look at their website, it just got so much information. So they release these annual reports that really break down death statistics in the county. And the most recent one that they have is from 2018, which I figure it's because it takes a long time to do that analysis and then put these reports together, and they've probably been backlogged by all of the things happening during 2020. Jordan talked about how many people died in the county overall, but only half of them about are reported to the medical examiner's office. And that's because deaths that occur in a hospital or hospice setting from a known natural disease process are not required to be reported to the medical examiner's office. So the medical examiner's office also doesn't take jurisdiction, so they don't take all of the cases that are reported to them, only the ones that meet certain criteria. 2,576 deaths were accepted by the medical examiner's office, and they performed autopsies in about 57% of those.
Oh, okay.
So 1,401. And of those, 4% were homicides.
Okay, so not many.
Not many, which...
we'll probably get the majority of them, to be honest.
Yeah, they try to give the trainees the homicides, especially if it's early on in the year, because we potentially might have the opportunity to testify in fellowship, which is rare. Yeah. Are you knocking for being able to practice testifying? Or...
yes, it's a skill that I know you were terrified of it, but like I want to... it's one of the things I'm excited about.
Yeah.
And also like I would rather do it in training when I have somebody watching me and helping me than if I am in my first real job.
No, for sure. I would rather get the experience during training.
You just don't want to ever have to do it.
I would rather never have to do it. But I understand it's an integral part of our job.
Yes. You'll be okay.
I'll be fine.
I'll be there to support you.
Sounds good. 12% were suicides. Okay. 6% traffic deaths. 32% accidental deaths.
Okay.
39% natural deaths. And 2% undetermined.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's about right.
Yeah. So a good spread. That was part of the appeal of going there for us as well, was we knew we would get a nice spread.
And then I dove a little bit into homelessness and then overdose deaths. Mm-hmm. So we all know that everywhere homelessness is a huge issue. It is also very bad in Seattle. And I saw a different breakdown based on the way that they broke it out, but long story short, overdoses are a huge chunk of deaths. From the period between November 2020 to February 2021, there were 65 homeless deaths. 32% of them were by overdoses.
Wow. A third?
Versus a little over a third is natural. But again, there are more naturals than overdoses, but natural includes cardiovascular, respiratory, CNS, cancer. So like all of these things.
Right.
But overdose is the biggest single cause. And then accident is third.
Hmm.
It's also like you can call accident overdose. So it's hard to like tease out exactly where they are in this.
Yeah.
But in 2018, in that year, there were 194 homeless deaths. So about 200, which is 25 more than the year before. And again, we have no idea what's happening in 2019 when all the bad things happened. The majority of these deaths were outside, a little over half, 55%, and then some of them were in vehicles or those that made it into hospitals and then died in the hospitals. Mm. We're going to transition into overdoses soon, but in terms of, like in Seattle in general, more people detox from heroin than from alcohol.
Whoa. What?
Yeah. So it is... We've been saying it's a huge issue, but it's a huge issue. There are so many people detoxing from alcohol, but it's an insanely distressing number of people.
Wow.
When you look at, you know, homeless deaths, they've been going up pretty steadily every year. So I said there was 194 in 2018. The year before was 169. The year before, 136, 124. So there's a distinct rise in homeless deaths from 2012 through 2018.
Maybe you didn't look this up, but is that because the population of, like, the proportion of homeless is rising also? So, like,
I don't know. This is not a proportion of percentage of homeless people or people experiencing homelessness.
Yes.
So I'm not exactly sure, but it is definitely going up. And the relative proportion of deaths within those are staying about the same. So it's around, like, high 30s, low 40s percent natural, around 30-ish percent from overdoses, and around, you know, 12-ish percent for accidents, non-overdose accidents.
Yeah.
So, you know, it seems to be proportional rise within the breakdown, but I don't know if it's just more homeless people, people experiencing homelessness. And then in terms of overdose deaths, the raw numbers went down a little bit in 2011. And then since 2011, they've been slowly and steadily rising. There was a much, much sharper rise in 2020, where there were 510 overall overdose deaths. And then if you look at 2021 so far, as of June 14th, so this is less than half a year.
Mm-hmm.
In 2020, there were 510.
Yeah.
Less than half a year, we're already at 299.
Ah.
So we are going to surpass, if these rates continue,
right,
the prior year. And much like everywhere else, usually it's either opioids, stimulants, or a combo of the two. And meth and fentanyl-related deaths are rising very quickly. There's a really good graph on the pure number of meth-involved deaths is higher than the number of fentanyl-involved deaths, but their rates of meth-involved deaths are going up a little slower than fentanyl-involved deaths, if that makes sense.
That is.
So fentanyl is increasing faster, but meth is still ahead of the race.
I mean, it makes sense to me, but I'm looking at the graph. We will post it to social media.
Yeah.
Send me the link.
Exactly, for sure. So a lot of the other drugs are staying pretty similar. Prescription opioid-involved deaths are staying in a pretty flat line. Heroin is starting to level off a little bit. But, you know, meth and fentanyl are really just skyrocketing. And there also is a graph that shows, like, broken down by quarter.
Oh.
So 2020 was definitely higher than 2019, but 2021 is just, like, taking the cake.
Yeah.
And this is of fentanyl-involved deaths that this graph is. So it's just, it's scary. It's terrifying.
Wow.
Overdoses are a problem everywhere. Seattle is not dissimilar.
Cool thing about Seattle, which we learned about on our interview day, was that since 2017, the King County Medical Examiner's Office has been building this drug surveillance network.
Yes.
So they have these rapid toxicology analyzers, so they can take blood from autopsy cases that day and get a preliminary result. They still have to get it confirmed by the lab that they send out all of their testing to, but getting these results same day that they do the autopsy, they can communicate that information to various organizations and they can essentially like find bad batches as different
drugs come through.
Yes, exactly.
And like a lot of offices do like a urine cup where mm-hmm. you put the urine in this cup and it has a bunch of rapid tests where it can tell you what it is. This is more accurate than those.
Yes, and it's covers a broader range of drugs.
Yes. So, yes. Yeah.
So their surveillance system that they've built up is pretty cool, and it'll be really nice to get involved with that next academic year. I was going to say next year, but
it's like soon.
Less than a month.
Yeah.
So other things that I wanted to talk about, mostly based on various podcasts that we both listen to about true crime, and then also when I was rotating at the medical examiner's office in San Francisco most recently, this issue of feet came up,
yes.
which Seattle / the Pacific Northwest actually famous for. Yes. So first, serial killers. According to the Radford Serial Killer Database, there have been around 75 serial killers in Washington State since 1900. So just Washington State, including some of the most notorious murderers in known history. The most notable of which is probably Ted Bundy.
For sure.
Yeah. And it's presumed that Bundy began killing in 1971 in his hometown of Seattle.
Woot.
And yeah, luckily he died. So, yep. You know, he's not on the streets anymore.
Been dextered.
Yeah. His total number of victims is unknown, but it's believed that he was responsible for the deaths of at least 30 women.
Yep.
And his modus operandi was to attract unsuspecting victims by faking injury and asking passersby for help. And he evaded being caught by moving around the country, and he killed women in 7 different states before he was finally caught and sentenced to the death penalty. And he died in the electric chair in 1989. Oh, the year before I was born.
The year I was born. Maybe I am Ted Bundy reincarnated.
You're so much more well-adjusted than he was, as far as I know. Maybe you secretly kill...
Maybe I'm going to be Dexter.
Maybe.
I'm going to kill the killers.
Can I see your collection of slides later? I wonder how many incidentally had some sort of pathology that he just never looked at. Anyway, the second most famous, probably from the list that I found, is the Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway. And he was convicted of 48 murders, but confessed to 71, spanning from 1982 to 1998.
That just takes up so much time.
I know.
How do you have that much time?
I know. What did he do for work? Like, how did he make enough money to kill people? You know what I'm saying? It costs money.
Maybe he killed people to make money.
Like, he just robbed them? Like, how many? Oh, no. I guess people carried cash more back in that day, true. But I certainly
charge
don't.
Those credit cards.
Hint, I do not care cash. Do not kill me for cash.
You will not get very far.
None. He earned his nickname after many of his victims were discovered along Washington's famous Green River. And most of his victims were young, vulnerable women, many of whom were sex workers who he had hired. And his preferred method of killing was strangulation, after which he would dump the bodies in the wooded areas around the river. He managed to evade capture for about 20 years after his first murder, but was eventually arrested in 2001. And in order to escape the death penalty, he accepted a plea bargain, confessing to 48 killings, for which he received 48 consecutive life sentences.
Well, that seems appropriate.
Yep. And then the last interesting story that I want to talk about are the Salish Sea Feet.
Not Cialis.
No. Salish. So as of 2019, 15 feet have washed ashore in the Pacific Northwest.
I love this so much. It's definitely one of the things that, like, we should go into more detail on this in some episode.
Yeah. It's got a whole Wikipedia page about it, which I didn't refer to. I just found other sources. The first foot was found in August of 2008 and the most recent in September of 2018. And only two, which have been... It's been found out they were from the same decedent, have yet to be linked to a missing person. So all of the rest of them have been linked to a missing person in a database. There were a lot of hypotheses about these feet. Like, at first, people thought that maybe these were all the work of a serial killer. but it turns out that there is a scientific explanation for why so many feet wash ashore in the Pacific Northwest. And to understand that, first, it's important to understand what happens to a body in water. And we've talked a little bit about how decomposition changes when a body is in water. But in 1942, this guy named Donahue, who was part of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, set out to settle the matter of human bodies in water with his 1977 article titled Human Body Buoyancy, a Study of 98 Men. So he got...
Why was it only men?
Because... men are the only ones who matter.
False. Cats matter too.
Cats matter more than men, for sure. So at the end of the study, it was suggested by the data that cadavers are overall more likely to sink than to float. And people who drown are the most likely to sink because of fluid in lungs and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, makes sense.
What happens to a body in water? It's very likely to sink. Why just the feet? In 2007, a forensic scientist, Gail Anderson of the Simon Fraser University, conducted a super cool study in the Salish Sea to understand how quickly a homicide victim would decompose in the ocean. And because basic ethic rules preclude the use of a human body, she used pigs for this study. But essentially, they dropped dead pigs into the Salish Sea. And they found that a pig carcass was very quickly eaten by all of the scavengers that are present in that body of water. So shrimp, lobsters, Dungeness crabs. And they started with the expected areas, aka the anus region and the facial orifices.
Yum.
Yes.
The most delicious part.
So it turns out, unsurprisingly, that these underwater scavengers will work around the bones and other tough parts of the body, preferring to pick apart the softer tissue. And unlike other joints, the ankles are made up mostly of soft stuff, so ligaments and other connective tissue. And so the scavengers in the Salish Sea are most likely to chew apart at these soft joints, so like the ankle. So the feet are disarticulated, so taken apart from the rest of the body pretty easily by these scavengers. And all of these feet that have washed up in the Pacific Northwest, there have been no evidence of tool marks on the bones, so it doesn't look like they've been severed, meaning someone didn't cut them off. They look like they've been taken off by scavenger activity, such as what was seen in these pig carcasses.
Yep.
And then feet wearing sneakers made in the last decade or so are almost certainly going to float. So sneakers over time have become more gas-filled and spongy, so more buoyant.
Yes.
So that also explains why in recent years it's more feet that have floated to the surface. So then if feet are likely to float away from dead bodies, why aren't beaches everywhere littered with feet? Why just the Salish Sea? And that's apparently...
Currents.
Yeah. The Salish Sea has the perfect combination of feet ensnaring properties. So first, it's a large, complex body of water. It's got lots of these little islands where feet can wash ashore. The prevailing winds go towards the west, so they bring in stuff from the ocean rather than pushing it out farther to sea. And then, because of the climate in the Pacific Northwest, more people in that area wear sneakers to the beach versus, like, flip-flops and stuff here, which would fall off and not help the foot be buoyant. So taken all together, it's more likely that the feet are going to wash up in this area. So they've found out who the owners of the feet are based on DNA analyses and comparing those to missing people databases. And then actually Kathy Taylor, the forensic anthropologist at the King County Medical Examiner's Office, was interviewed for one of the articles that I referred to. And she has done a lot of advocating for shoe size to be included in standard missing persons reports to make the feet easier to match up, because, you know, it's only going to get more and more over time, especially because all of the media attention to this phenomenon have encouraged people who see shoes on the beach to check for feet.
Oh.
You know.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. So that's the reason why it's probably becoming more prevalent as well. I think it's British Columbia Coroner System has this really cool map of the various feet that have washed ashore. And I'll post that. Well, we'll post that to social media because I'll send you the link for it as well. But it's a pretty interesting map. So chances are we might get a foot, you know.
Does it count as a full autopsy?
Does
it count towards our 200? And because we did say it at the beginning, a while back, Nicole had gotten me a Teeling whiskey small batch or Teeling whiskey tasting set, which I somehow didn't realize we hadn't gone all the way through. So when I was packing stuff up to move, I realized we had one left. So we finished off our Teeling whiskey. We had their small batch Irish whiskey, which is non-chill filtered and aged in rum casks. Or sorry, finished in rum casks.
Ooh.
And its Teeling is called the Spirit of Dublin.
It was very tasty.
It's very good. And a little spicy kick to it.
Yeah. And recording two episodes today, so that was our half shot for this first episode.
Yes. The second one will break out something else.
Yeah.
As does any good alcohol company, we should have a really good social media presence as well.
Always with the excellent segues. So if you liked this and any of our other episodes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. It's how we get boosted up on the various podcasting platforms and other people learn about us.
You can visit our website at deadmandotellpodcast.com, where we'll link to all of our sources and our episode guide.
On Twitter, we're at deadmando.
On Insta, we're at the Dead Tell Tales.
And our Facebook page is Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And as always, please send us an email with questions, comments, concerns through the website or directly to thedeadtelltales@gmail.com.
And our opening theme music is Introducing the Pre-Roll by Lee Rosevear, who you can find on SoundCloud.
So thank you guys for being so patient for not recording for a while. And hopefully we'll have these two out to you and our normal time frame.
Yes, and hopefully from then on, we will be recording on our usual schedule, which should be easier because we're going to be living together.
Yes, so much better. Okay.
Yeah, so thank you.
Thanks. Bye, guys.
Bye.